Hey, this is Russell, and I work at the video store, the place that we can go to every week when it's movie night. On days like today, when the store is quiet, I get to chat to my friends about the films and the series that we're loving. All right, let's do it. Let's open up the shop.
Did you see that thing yesterday on the TV?
How's it?
Hello.
Good morning.
How's it?
How's it?
Hello, everyone.
How's it?
Welcome to the video store. Thank you for popping in. Thank you for wandering into our lovely video store. My name is Russell. I am the owner of The Bioscope, which is an independent cinema here in Johannesburg. And when not doing that, I manage this lovely video store. Today, I've got myself a Perrin.
Yes.
Who opened with an Australian Liam Hemsworth? What's his name?
Yeah, Chris Hemsworth.
Chris Hemsworth, yeah. In Furiosa.
Yeah. Hello.
Hello.
Yeah.
Apparently, you're an editor and
a writer,
a whole bunch of stuff.
Yeah.
We're not working at the video store, and then we got ourselves a Gaddy.
Hey, hey.
Gad makes candy. He owns the Gaddles Candy Company. Mm. But he also plays in Short Straw with me, and you've worked at a video store.
A real video store.
A real video store.
Well, I mean, compared to like video stores I used to go to, it was a very uncommercial one.
No, but you were at a very cool one. It was called DVD Gurus.
Oh, in Melville.
And it was in Melville.
Yeah.
And so Gaddy was very cool.
Yeah, I watched so many movies back then. I don't need to watch any more now.
Yeah. No, you've done your...
You slowly morphed into... Quentin Tarantino.
Yeah.
You've done your time. And so, yeah, we are just behind the counter here of our video store. We're going to talk about all the movies in the series that we've enjoyed this past week, as well as some interesting movie entertainment news. One thing to get out very quickly for all of those browsing the shelves, I'm just going to make a very quick announcement here.
Attention all customers, this is to let you know that the video store is going to host you guys at a very special screening of the movie Better Man. This is the exciting Robbie Williams biopic where he is the monkey. That is usually enough to have people know what I'm talking about. This is going to be on the 23rd of January. The screenings are going to be at 8 p.m. in both Joburg and Cape Town. We've got tickets to give away. The Joburg screening is going to be at Monte Cassino. Cape Town is at New Metro Canal Walk. What you need to do is you need to listen out to our Instagram feed. Pay attention to that and look for the Attention All Customers post, where we want you to let us know why you should join us on the 23rd of Jan at these screenings. And we would love to have you join us. We're going to give away some tickets.
All right. Lekker.
I think something quite important to start off with is the LA fires that are happening at the moment.
Sure.
Yeah.
No, it's like obviously going to have big knock-on effects with Hollywood, and it's affected like a lot of people.
Yeah, sure.
And it's crazy what's happening. And
it's one of those things where all of a sudden you realize like you do have friends out there.
Yeah,
so
crazy.
I messaged Tom from Short Straw to just go like, are you all right?
And he's
Yeah, he's like, I landed in what felt like a very weird city, and he knows lots of people that have lost everything.
Yeah.
But he's like, thankfully, I stay quite far away
from
the fires, but still.
There's that one photo of sun setting on LA, and it looks like, sun rising. It looks like a gateway to hell. Like, it's crazy.
Do you remember the movie Volcano?
Yes.
Which was the really weird swing.
Yeah, yeah.
It was that twin movie where
with
it came
Dante's
out.
Dante's Peak, yeah.
Same year as Dante's Peak, but it was the whole thing was LA is actually a volcano. Meanwhile, there's no fucking volcano. But it just came up out of the ground, the lava.
Yeah.
And some of those scenes look like the movie Volcano.
Yeah, it's nuts. Like, I know there's a picture of Harrison Ford that's circulating where he's like sitting in the back of like an ambulance or a car or something. And he looks like proper like...
Defeated,
like worried, like... Yeah, I'm going to lose everything, you know.
Sure. Well, speaking of losing things, I think it's worth mentioning that we lost David Lynch.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You were the first to share it in our group, Perrin.
Yeah.
And in a way of honoring him, we immediately started talking about what movie the Bioscope could screen. Mm. At least one. I want to do more. But at least one that could best honor him and celebrate him. So I want us to chat about that. But we tend to start our days here with a little game called Hey, Did You Guys See?
Yes.
So I want to get into that. But yeah, we will talk about David Lynch. I want to hear more from your brain, especially yours, Perrin and cool. Gaddy, if you in your DVD guru's days watched a lot of David Lynch. I watched a very cursory amount.
I mean, okay, I got you.
I got the basics in.
Yeah. I've seen, there's not actually that many Lynch movies.
Yeah.
There's like 7 or 8.
Yeah.
I've seen them.
I haven't seen all of them. I've seen sort of like 3 of the more obvious ones. So I want to learn more about David Lynch, and I hope that others will sort of learn through me learning. Mm. We are going to talk about A Real Pain, which myself and Gaddy went to go watch.
So good.
We went to the premiere of it. Perrin, you've had a chance to see it. And then we got some nice TV stuff to chat about at the end.
Yeah, good, great.
Okay,
stuff.
So yeah, let's get into it. Let's start with a little. Hey, did you guys see?
Do you know who Uwe Boll is?
Oh, that really bad director who makes a video game.
Yeah, he makes. Adaptations. He's made like the worst video game adaptations.
Okay.
His upcoming movie called The Dark Knight, unrelated to the Batman saga, he has put Armie Hammer in the lead.
Okay.
So Armie Hammer, as you know, disgraced the cannibal. Yeah. He's trying to rebuild his career. He's got a podcast now where he's like trying to be as transparent as possible with himself and his guests. And Uwe Boll is like consistently regarded as the worst director working today. He's a German strongman, or he's Dutch, I can't remember, but he's one of the two. And he famously beat up some of his film critics. He called his movies the worst movies ever, and he would challenge them to boxing matches, and he would win. He's an absolute lunatic.
What are some of his biggest turds?
He did Blood. Let me go through the.
Did Rolodex he do Blood Rain?
He did Blood Rain. He did. There was that zombie shoot 'em up game in an arcade game that he did. House of the Dead, I think.
Okay.
He did that.
All right, but it's not even like they were. Huge famous flops. No. They were just floppy shit movies.
Awful. So he has so much confidence as well. If you want to get into Uwe Boll, like the mythology of the man, go check his Letterboxd account. His movie reviews are legitimately insane. Like he often his reviews of other movies, he'll be like, shit, the women are hot, but the movie's shit. Or he'll be like, the women are shit, and the movie is shit.
It's sounding the way in which, listen, that all the Dutch people I know are the nicest people in the world.
He's German.
He's German. But that kind of sensibility, they cut through a lot of bullshit.
Yeah.
And they really, some of those kinds of Europeans can get straight to the point and be borderline quite rude.
So these were big games like Postal and Alone in the Dark. Far Cry, Rampage. Yeah. He did a few of those.
But
straight to video schlock.
Sure, but let's get back to it. He is going to cast Armie Hammer.
So it's signed, sealed, and delivered. They start shooting, I think, this month or next month.
I saw a little post out of that sort of Armie Hammer camp, which said something like, apparently he's back and he's having to turn down roles, which is just press from
PR,
his side sort of trying to do it. But just without opening up too much of a can of worms here, I mean, he was never wanting to literally eat someone, right?
No, apparently he just had really sketchy texts with women that he was talking to about requesting that stuff.
He apparently said this is all taken out of context. It was that sentiment of I just want to eat you up, a cute little baby. You just want to like cute little baby toes. I just want to eat them up.
Yeah.
Apparently that was the sentiment.
I don't buy it.
It's one of the I don't know, but it's one of those things where it's like, Jesus, bro. what?
I just want to eat you up.
let's not spend the whole time talking about this asshole. For those who are perhaps wondering who he is, he was the guy who played the twins in The Social Network.
Yeah, he was in Call Me By Your Name.
He was in Call Me By Your Name. He's a very handsome guy. He was in Death on the Nile. And you know what? If you got something weird like that going on, keep it to yourself if you can. But if it does affect others, then fuck you.
Yeah, exactly.
So, okay. Can we move on?
Yeah.
Hey, did you guys see the trailer for The Monkey?
No. Did you see it, Gad?
I did not.
No. Okay, well, let me just tell you
about
it.
The monkey that isn't the Robbie Williams movie.
Yeah. This is a different monkey, yeah. So we've got...
Scary monkey.
Yeah, this is a scary monkey. We have ourselves Osgood Perkins, who's got arguably one of the coolest names in the film industry.
Yeah.
He is a director who got quite a nice leg up last year with the movie Long Legs.
Yeah.
Pun
intended. So he's a very interesting... filmmaker who I think we must be celebrating these people that are starting to become auteurs. It tends to happen a bit more in the horror genre, but these kind of more younger filmmakers that are just putting out cool, exciting,
interesting ideas.
And this is now his adaptation of a Stephen King short.
Yeah.
Called The Monkey. And it's a... It looks relatively straightforward as an idea. Mm. There's this little toy monkey that's got a drum that it plays.
I think you wind
and
up.
And you wind it up, okay. And this monkey seems to be possessed to the point that it can use what's in the room and be able to kill you.
Okay, because those things terrify
and
me.
And it got bound up and locked up and buried in a well, and somehow it's made its way back. And it's torturing the sort of the life of the sort of one guy in particular.
Great.
But it looks cool. It looks really cool. And also a nice shout out to Empire Entertainment, who's the distributor of this content. They wanted the Bioscope to be a collaborator on the announcement of the trailer, which I thought was very cool.
Yeah.
So they asked if they could collaborate on the post, and it was just cool for the Bioscope to be included in that, which was cool. So it was nice to put it out together.
I'm glad they're bringing more neon films out now.
Yeah.
So like Anora's coming as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Long Legs was neon.
Yeah.
Which is also a little bit like A24, which I think is a very exciting...
Like a sister distributor almost. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think there's something very interesting about the fact that we've got these cool distribution labels. That are existing, and for those in the know, it's a curation that you can really get behind.
Yeah,
and there's something very cool and exciting about what these labels are doing and how.
Yeah, what directors they are pledging their like faith on. You know.
Yeah, but also I would be curious to know whether in the past, like let's just pick a random day in the 60s or the 70s. You know, did these small little labels exist, these distribution companies? Did they have
studios,
credibility? Yeah. Because before, it felt like they were always just the big ones, right? And
it was
a little bit
like Orion films.
Yeah, Miramax in the 90s and
80s. Dino De Laurentiis.
Okay, so there has been a tradition of it. But something like Miramax, wasn't that quite big?
So Miramax started out as like almost a lot of people, like all these old guys who are... seeing A24's like this almost cult-like fan base building up from it. A lot of them say that Miramax was their A24 in the 90s.
Okay, so that's cool. It's nice to understand that because it's...
they did Pulp Fiction and all these, like, they brought up guys as well.
Cool. You forget how little they could have been. So that's nice that there is that tradition. And then it also, harpers on the fact that it's all about curation.
Mm.
So A24 and the Neons of the world, like, can't put out shit.
Yeah.
They really have to look after now more than ever which films they actually get behind or make.
Yeah, like I'm in an A24 group on Facebook, and people are constantly like updating their rankings list of A24 and like all the highest grossing A24 movies. Every time a new one comes out,
it gets updated.
It's exciting. It's cool. I think that's so exciting. And so for me, when I upgraded the Bioscope, I could now screen these kinds of movies, and my sights were set on the Neons and the A24s of the world. I didn't spend all the money to screen the big Hollywood distribution stuff.
Yeah, it was very weird stuff.
Because the weird stuff was being made, you know, on this level where you needed this equipment in order to screen it, and the Bioscope could be the place that could screen these kinds of movies.
Yeah,
because a lot of A24 stuff, you don't want to go to a shopping mall to watch.
Yeah. Mm.
It's just not the place for it. You don't want to walk past the fucking Postnet and the Spur to, you know, to watch this like amazing, beautiful piece of art. You want to sit in a beautiful courtyard. You want to drink a cocktail. You want to eat.
Yeah, that's why Cinema Nouveau was always such a weird kind of experience.
Yeah. But I just am so chuffed that the bias go,
yeah, you get to
is doing that and can do that now and does it so confidently. And like I said last week, we had that sold out weekend of A Complete Unknown. This week, sold out weekend of Nosferatu.
Yeah.
So it's like, you don't want to go watch Nosferatu in the shopping mall.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I'm just so chuffed. And the Bioscope is off to such a great start.
That's good. Yeah, it's great.
And
man,
a film like The Monkey is going to come at the end of Feb, the last Friday of Feb.
Mm.
And the Bioscope is fucking here for it.
Sick.
All right. Getty, you got one?
Yeah, I think, well, you did, but Perrin, have you guys seen the new OK Go music video?
No, I haven't. I saw you posting it. Yeah, I haven't watched it yet.
So cool.
I love how creative their music videos are. It's always fucking
It's a beautiful
crazy.
Short film. It just happens to be to music.
Yeah.
But it's such okay, so for those who don't know, OK Go is a great band who have put up their hand to be the band that makes interesting, innovative music videos.
Yeah,
the
most cool. Like generally one take videos. Yeah. I think like that's their thing.
It's a concept.
Very practical.
And it's a thought that then requires crazy execution.
It's almost like they adhere to the Michel Gondry technique, you know, where they're doing all these crazy cool things and like you say, one take generally.
And it's very practical, which
yeah,
is cool. It's not about CGI and guys sort of doing it. So
the whole idea is it's 64 phones,
okay,
which they've lined up on a table, which when all played together make up different images.
That's
or
cool.
Different videos. So basically all of these videos on the 64 different phones were filmed separately.
That's
and
crazy.
Planned. And
so they had to, yeah, they had cool, to, man. They had to plan to the fucking T.
Yeah, I remember
every
that.
Single moment. And of course, what I think is a very interesting thing to think about with music videos is you can't just have one idea.
Mm.
It can't just be the one thing because even over the course of your average song, which is 3 minutes, you've got to step it up.
Yeah.
You've got to take it to another level and you've got to take it to ideally a third level. You've got to keep someone captivated. And so they present this idea that that these videos, and you could see the guy's face perhaps made up out of 3 or 4 phones. Then it spans up. Then the way that they play through the phones.
Yeah.
It's just so exciting.
That's the logistics to do that, man.
And like, and yes. So they are now on YouTube, OK Go's channel is just like a great channel.
Yeah.
Because it's just so filled with these videos, amazing videos. The most famous of which was the treadmills.
The treadmill, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
But even there was one that was just this beautiful dance, like a coordinated dance sequence. It was one of the earliest ones.
It ends up with the umbrellas at the end.
Is that the one they did in Japan, I think?
Yeah. Because the lead singer's sister is a choreographer.
Oh, that makes sense.
So she choreographed a lot of that early stuff.
But there was a brilliant one with printers.
Yes,
they set
I
up like thousands
one.
Of printers and all the pages come down and then just makes these images.
Oh. So cool.
Yeah. No, and there was the one where the whole music video was shot in 2 seconds.
And then they slowed
and
it down.
And then they slowed it all down and you sort of saw exactly what happened.
The paint spraying.
Oh,
and
so smart. But yeah, good call. And we'll put a link to the music video in the description below. And if you don't know OK Go, you've got the next half an hour to an hour fucking sorted.
Okay, so hey, did you guys see that Supreme Leader Trump has tasked a hit force to reinvigorate Hollywood and to make Hollywood strong again?
Sending in our best men here.
Yeah, and he's picked the most relevant strong men in Hollywood of John Voight, Mel Gibson, and Sylvester Stallone. To do the job. So
Stallone was a surprise. I mean, I knew about the other
two. He's more relevant than the other two.
But also, like, I didn't know he was that way inclined.
Oh, no, he
John
he
Voight
is.
Was...
John Voight's crazy. Mel Gibson is insane.
Yeah. but a lot of it is about Trump trying to solve, like, kind of, like, labor issues and costs. And the fact that, you know, for those who don't know, it's cheaper for a whole American film production to move to Cape Town to shoot a film than it is to do it...
Shoot it in L.A.
Shoot it in L.A.
Certain tax rebates in certain states.
Yeah.
But But also, I think a big issue for the right is that a lot of media, whether it's film or television, is kind of made with left idealism.
Mm.
And conservative movies, like are movies
always that dog shit.
They're always terrible. And there's like no representation or whatever for people on the right.
No,
and
the right conservative movies tend to play it too safe and too easy because, they obviously want to, fight the woke liberal media, and they just always awful movies. Like the Reagan movie is apparently terrible. They just did a Ronald Reagan biopic with Dennis Quaid.
Okay.
I'm interested to see what they're actually going to do because
I'd imagine they're going to do next to nothing.
Yeah, I mean,
and
they
I think
haven't
it's a weird sort of symbolic post.
Yeah, and of course, let's bring back Mel Gibson, who is notoriously anti-Semitic and homophobic and everything, to make Hollywood strong again because the snowflake liberals are whenever there's representation, that's woke nonsense. It's just so stupid. One of my favorite jokes was someone posted a tweet or something. It was like, the woke left without saying goodbye.
He was on Rogan recently, Mel Gibson.
Oh, yeah?
Spewing, what's the horse paste again that everyone was taking during COVID?
Yeah, didn't he say that cured his COVID or some shit?
Cures cancer.
He said he had two or three friends that had their lives turned around because of that stuff. But he's got a strange sort of attitude on him now. It feels like he struggles to say each word. He sort of puts a funny facial expression, and it's like he's struggling
to the horse paste.
It's like he's struggling to put sentences together.
Yeah,
wild.
But I mean, it's just interesting because none of them. I mean, Sylvester Stallone. I don't even know if his expendable movies are hits anymore. Like the new ones that he makes. Because how are you gonna make the most irrelevant big man action stars like your Task Force? I mean, John Voight. Also, his last movie was fucking Megalopolis. Mel Gibson hasn't done anything in ages.
John Voight was Anaconda, right?
Yeah.
famously. His
Deliverance sizzle.
Daughter's Angelina Jolie.
Yes. Yeah.
Wasn't he in Tomb Raider?
I'm pretty sure he was. Okay.
I love the fact that there's that Anaconda movie in production coming out, which is with Paul Rudd
got a good cast.
And Jack Black, where they're going to recreate... Well, they're going to reshoot the movie Anaconda, but I think they then encounter a real anaconda.
Oh, so it's almost like Tropic Thunder.
Yeah, it's like a meta film. It's coming. It's on its way.
Oh, cool.
I don't know whether they've shot it yet, but that's
tonight
the plan.
Tonight on E, a snake will kill you.
Yeah. Shit.
Nimrod,
Okay, should we get into the movies?
Yes.
All right, let's talk about movies. Myself and Gaddy went to go watch A Real Pain. This is the... writing and directing of Jesse Eisenberg, who we know as the lead from Social Network and
Lex Luthor.
Now You See Me.
Is he Lex Luthor?
He was Lex Luthor.
Why?
he in an interview, Shame was like, that wasn't a good one.
Yeah.
And that one didn't do necessarily that well.
I know someone...
He's a bit ashamed of that role.
Yeah, I know. I like to troll... Like, every now and then I like to go down rabbit holes of people saying, oh, my encounter with these celebrities and stuff. And someone apparently said to Eisenberg, like, I loved you in Batman vs. Superman. And he said, I've done better films. That's his response.
Yeah. But this is him writing and directing. It's not his first film. He's done one or two others, and he's done plays, so he definitely understands dialogue in the way in which the plays really sort of specialize in that.
I think it is his directorial debut in film, at least.
No, there's others. Yeah,
really?
Yeah. Huh. Double check me, but I'm pretty sure he's done one or two.
Yeah, probably like short films or something.
Yeah, but what it is it's. Two cousins, Jesse Eisenberg and Kieran Culkin, who is his cousin, go on a special tour of Europe. They are on a Holocaust tour.
Poland specifically.
Of Poland, where they are going to try and see the house that their grandmother grew up in. And It's just the most incredible road trip movie. It's a buddy comedy. It is just delightful. It's got lots of brevity and fun, but beautiful and heartfelt and somber in moments. It's a very much a Bioscope film. And so we're very excited to screen it from next weekend.
So what I loved about this movie is, like, they both are from America, and Americans have this reputation in Europe as being, like, brash and asking lots of questions.
Yeah, especially in the sort of tour group.
In the tour group thing. And they had this amazing contrast because, I related so much to Jesse Eisenberg, just like his awkwardness and
100%.
His way that he pulls away from reality, and like he lingers on these moments in the movie that most people would cut away from, and it brings this like realness. And the two of them are like opposite ends of the scale, but they aren't like this normal tourist that you'd imagine Americans to be.
Yeah,
and they, through this journey that they take, they're like. Change the life of the tour guide in a way, which I found to be like the most interesting journey throughout the movie.
Cheers, thanks, David.
he gives him this long, like, wow, thank you for doing this. He just goes, okay, good. Cheers, thanks, David. That was so funny. Jeez.
It's incredible, and I really there's every now and again a movie will crop up that I can't help as a former film student. And someone who plays a little part in the South African film industry by screening the end product. I can't help but feel that every now and again there's a great movie that comes up that you should screen to students, and you should explain to them that you can make this movie.
Yeah.
Nothing,
so simple.
Absolutely nothing is stopping you from making this movie.
Yeah. Totally.
It's your brain and it's your time and it's your heart to put that kind of script together. Not everyone can do that. So that's going to take all your attention. But budget-wise, what's possible, like anyone could have made that movie.
Very small special effects budget.
Yeah.
No,
and
the titles.
And to look at character. So you've got these two cousins, one of which is a very gregarious, everybody sort of loves him in a way, and he can really sort of capture the room.
Yeah.
This is Kieran Culkin's character. But then it's interesting to see his arc and how over the course of these few days you see the pitfalls of that. You can't be this perfect showman that everybody loves all the time. There's got to be something that you're kind of masking, where Jesse Eisenberg's character was this very sort of shy, understated introvert who then has to find some confidence, and where the other one's confidence falters. And so there's such a beautiful character study, and I think you must go into this movie paying attention to what you see, what you don't see, what they say, what they don't say, and how he's painted these nuanced characters.
Yeah, like one thing I do also really appreciate about it is that it's dealing with these two characters who deal with grief very differently. So they're on a tour, a Holocaust tour, where naturally there would be some grief involved in that, right? Especially of these two people who are visiting Poland to visit their grandmother's house that she grew up in, right? But like, I find it so interesting how Kieran Culkin's character and Jesse Eisenberg, who are these very opposite personality types in the movie, how they just deal with grief differently. Like, Kieran Culkin tends to wallow in it, even though he lights up the room. There's that great line that Jesse Eisenberg says in it. He's like, every room you go into, you light up the room and then immediately shit all over it.
Yeah,
and
perfect.
That's what he does. And Kieran Culkin is so good in it as well, is that what I love about these two actors is that they're playing their, almost like their typecast in the movie.
Yes,
you know,
very
Jesse Eisenberg plays the anxious, nervous guy, and then Kieran Culkin, the overly confident, you know, light up the room, shit on it attitude. But what their characters, what they do so well with their characters is that they just respect their characters enough to just give us very real portrayals of how these people would deal with those situations. And I mean, there's that great scene where they finally go to a death camp, like sequence, and it's so respectful and so like, there's no music, there's no over the top jokes and stuff like that. It's just, it's like 3 minutes of just them there.
And what's, then they leave, what's so lovely is so the tour has a tour guide. And so we actually experience the tour as if we are on the tour with them. Mm. And the tour guide gives this lovely introduction where, as they're about to go into the camp,
yeah.
how one could, you know, and he says something along the lines of, you've heard me talk, but I'm not going to say anything yeah. here. And so you immediately are ushered into silence. Yeah. But you talking about authentic portrayal, there's a lovely conversation which comes up often when they've done press as actors where they've said that Kieran Culkin would do a scene and Jesse Eisenberg, who's acting alongside him, but also notes. The director yeah. would say, well, that was great, but could you do this? Could you change that? And he would admit to saying, I don't know what I did, bro. Like, I just fucking did it.
Yeah.
But he'd say, but in that sense, he wouldn't be unhelpful about it. He yeah. would then say, I'll give you as many takes as you want, but I just don't know what I do.
Yeah.
And I think there's something really cool that he's revealing in that moment, that as an actor, he's just so in the moment that he's not paying attention to like what his hand is doing.
And, yeah.
You know, you feel that a lot with music, especially in drums.
Yeah.
You're either like just the rhythm is in you, or you are meticulously mechanical about what you do.
Yeah.
Is it all rhythm, or is it all calculated thought?
100%, yeah.
I think what you get as a result just feels so authentic.
And that's the thing with Kieran Culkin as well, is that always he's so unpredictable in press interviews and everything. He's got this, even in Succession, like he's got this energy about him where I don't know what he's going to do next. And that's what I felt in A Real Pain. Like
yeah.
I was always waiting for a blow up moment. You know, the inevitable buddy comedy movie where they have their inevitable fight and they split apart
yeah.
and breaks them apart and changes their equilibrium going forward. But one thing I appreciated about the film is that when there is that blow up moment, it's not over the top where it shakes the foundations of the film.
Yeah.
It just reveals little new nuances to their characters.
Yeah.
And like I said, the whole backdrop of grief where these two guys are there to pay respect to their grandmother, who one didn't speak to as much as the other. And it's just interesting to see how they handle that, and also how they handle their arcs going forward by the end of the movie. And that's another good example to show film students, is that you can say all this in only 90 minutes.
Yes.
So effectively.
Yeah. So
I love that.
Yeah.
It's so well paced.
At the moment, the Bioscope is dealing with a lot of long movies.
Mm.
Complete Unknown is over 2 hours. Better Man's over two
Nosferatu.
Hours. Nosferatu is over 2 hours. The Brutalist is coming out soon.
I'm so excited.
Which
oh my
is
God,
three and a half hours with an intermission. But still, okay. like these are big epic movies.
Mm.
I loved sort of seeing that runtime and going like, oh, this is just a fun, easy hour and a half.
Yeah, I love
it.
Like,
it's
love
almost
that,
to the point where it's a bit novel.
It's my like, sweet spot, yeah.
They don't really make them like that anymore.
Some of the most effective movies I've watched over the past few years have been between 70 and 80 and 90 minutes. Like. Yeah. Because it's tight and concise.
I watched the new Wallace and Gromit movie. I think
that was
cute. Like 82 minutes.
Yeah.
Or like under 80 minutes.
Yeah.
Which is perfect.
Yeah.
Exactly what you needed. Yeah.
Should we talk about David Lynch? Because I don't want to spend too much time on other things. I find it interesting to... It's unfortunate that we've got to use this moment to go back and look at his career.
Mm.
But it's just unfortunately the way that these things work.
Yeah.
I watched Blue Velvet in varsity. I think we watched Lost Highway in varsity, and then I watched Mulholland Drive.
Yeah. I saw Mulholland Drive in the cinema at Cinema Nouveau when it came out.
So lucky. I was too
You
young.
Must have been very young.
I was in high school.
Yeah.
So I was like I was in grade 16 or 17.
Yeah, I was in grade 3.
I was still at the age where we were renting a video from the video store every Sunday as a family.
Mm.
When we were very young, we used to rent two. And myself and my sister were downstairs in the study watching the kids' movie. And my parents would watch the adult movie.
Yeah.
And then when we got old enough, we then obviously all watched the movie together. And I remember us giving Mulholland Drive a go. And my parents just being like, what?
This is
a bit weird. And then the boobies come out, and then the fucking dude around the corner.
Yeah, oh, I remember the being biggest scare of my life.
I remember being so haunted.
It's the scariest jump scare I've ever seen in a film.
It's wild.
It's fucking terrifying.
And I remember obviously like having this moment as a high school kid, remembering this, and then
traumatized.
Once in the middle of nowhere, when the thought came to me, like, that dude that was behind the...
The Winkies, yeah.
Behind the building in the movie Mulholland Drive. If you've seen it, you know exactly what we're talking about. Otherwise, in this movie, there's a point where they've got to go around the corner in this kind of arbitrary shopping center parking lot.
Yeah.
And there's this person whose face you see. And as an adult, I remember Googling it, going... Mulholland Drive dude around the corner, because I was like, what did he look like again? Because in my head,
like a witch, almost like a burnt charred witch. It was
in my head, terrifying. It was so scary. But anyways, I mean, that was that's really me. I haven't seen much more of David Lynch.
Okay.
Perhaps Perrin, you want to kick us off? Like, what are the what how could you encapsulate him?
So for me, I think, regardless of what you think about his movies, I think David Lynch is one of the most influential filmmakers of all time, not just in movies, but in music as well. He is so distinctly, I mean, there's a term, Lynchian, is attributed to him.
And what is that term?
So Lynchian is, if it's surreal, if it's fucking weird, if it's dreamlike, if it's nightmare-like, people often refer it as Lynchian, you know, where it's like almost like feels arbitrary, the weirdness of it all.
Because when we watched a movie like Lost Highway, and I think Mulholland Drive is similar, you get shown a story,
and you're
on a path, and then about halfway through the movie,
everything
swaps, and you're now in another fucking half.
Yeah,
everything is now from the perspective of it. Bug.
Yeah.
But it's and I sort of,
or the
remember,
nuclear bomb in Twin Peaks.
Yeah. I remember asking the lecturer, like, what the fuck?
Yeah.
And he said, Google, and this is for the folks overhearing us now, Google a Mobius strip, which is that's what this narrative does. It's almost like a roller coaster. Imagine it sort of going and sort of looping around itself.
Yeah.
So it actually subverts itself and it flips.
Yeah.
So that you actually find yourself in a completely upside down world and you're actually watching another movie.
Yeah.
And it doesn't make sense because there is this point where you flip into another world.
But that's what I love about his work. So he started really doing that from Lost Highway, because he did that with Inland Empire as well. Mulholland Drive, obviously, very notably. But like with... So Mulholland Drive is my favorite Lynch film, and that's one film that, for me, when I say it's the best interactive movie I've watched, I'm not talking about like you choose your own adventure thing, right? With that movie, it's like a puzzle. Every time you find a new corner or a new piece that puts together the picture, it's like so satisfying because you're like, fuck, that's what it means. But then you go and read, and then other people have completely different opinions on what X, Y, and Z means, or you know, and that's what I love about that era of Lynch films, is that he really makes you work for it and he doesn't give you answers. Like, some of it may be random, some of it may be completely arbitrary, but that's what good film is supposed to do, is to make you like hypothesize things differently, or you know, you read it differently, so the film is actually about this, or this connects to that. You know what I mean?
And it could change every time you think about
it. Exactly,
yeah. On Wednesday, the 29th of Jan, I've carved out another Video Store Presents night. Mm. And what this is it's internal. It's us as the Video Store clerks going, oh my God, you haven't seen that, or you should really watch that. And it's us actually trying to watch a movie that we haven't seen, or that one person has seen that really loves, that some of the other guys in the team haven't seen.
Yeah.
And I really want to use Wednesday the 29th as a Video Store Presents night to present a David Lynch film. Mm. So if you had to pick, P-Dog, what would you screen?
What do you want to watch?
So the thing with Lynch... So you obviously got the heavy hitters. You got Mulholland Drive. You've got,
Blue Velvet.
Blue Velvet. You've got
Lost Highway.
Lost Highway. But then you've got the film that, I mean, Eraserhead is, in my opinion, probably the greatest experimental American film. He spent 5 years making that.
I saw that in a cinema at the Grahamstown Festival.
Oh, wow.
That was amazing.
Yeah. So, I mean, that is so... thing is, you also got to look at what is the most quintessentially David Lynch. I think Eraserhead might be that.
Yeah.
But then you've got to also look at the most un-David Lynch films, right?
So Straight Story.
Straight Story is incredible, right? So you got that and Elephant Man, who are easily his most accessible films. Elephant Man is one of the saddest movies ever made. It's so fucking good. Fun fact, that is the film, that's the reason why the Academy Awards introduced hair and makeup as a category. Because they saw that and they were like, okay, we've got to add this in the next.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah. Hmm. So,
fun fact is Beauty and the Beast created the animation category.
Oh, that's crazy.
What sort of inspired them to sort of...
Yeah, because it was only shorts before that, yeah, which is nuts.
We need an animated feature category.
So with Lynch, I mean, and then you got Mulholland Drive, which I think is probably his greatest movie, but his most un-Lynch film is A Straight Story, where it's about a man riding a tractor across country to go see his brother who just had a stroke.
I'm quite excited to watch that one.
So...
It's so unassuming.
It's so beautiful.
It's just like it flows and it's like you don't even notice like the length of the movie.
Well, one of the funniest.
And do you think he's almost making a joke about his filmmaking by calling it that?
I don't think so. I mean, maybe because it's based
it's sort
on
of
a
an
true
added
story.
Level.
Yeah.
But it's
yeah, I think it is actually because like
it's him going, this is a simple straight narrative because famously, as we've said, his narratives aren't straight.
And he didn't write this one. So, but what I love about it is it's the only film he did for Disney.
Okay.
Each of his movies was a different studio.
Yeah, 100%. Like, I think with The Straight Story, like, early on in the movie, there's Lynchian's, like, stuff. There's the camera movement. There's strange things that are happening where you're like, okay, this is very David Lynch. But then as the movie progresses, you forget that it's a David Lynch movie in the best way possible. You know what I mean? Okay. Like Lynch doesn't, that's what I love about David Lynch is that he's so into what he's trying to say. You get what I'm saying? So with The Straight Story, it's just a lovely road movie. And one of the best descriptions of it is it's a slow road movie that feels fast. You know what I mean? Like it's doesn't feel fast, but it's like you said, it's so unassuming. It's just so delicate. And I think that's a film that really represents, because whenever you're seeing all these messages about David Lynch and stuff, over even before he died, people have always said he's the warmest, loveliest person to work with. He's a proper collaborator. He is just such a sweet, kind, warm person. And this movie, it deals with aging. Like, that's the main theme. But it feels so warm, and it feels like only David Lynch could have made that. You know what I mean?
So interesting. I'm tempted to then try and do that.
Yeah.
To try and screen that, because Blue Velvet, Mulholland Drive, Last Highway are dark, but they're also, they're the obvious ones.
Yeah.
And they're the more like, most people who would come to an independent cinema to watch a David Lynch homage screening,
they don't expect A Straight Story.
They would have seen these other ones.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying, is most people who are into David Lynch have not seen A Straight Story, even if they are huge David Lynch fans. I don't know if it's because they shy away from it because it seems it's a family film. It's not a
It's the more commercial of the lot.
Yeah, it's the Field of Dreams of his filmography.
100%, 100%. And
who are you likening that to?
Or just in terms of like the
what
family
was for warmth? Yeah. What was Field of Dreams for the makers of that movie?
No, well, just in terms of the movie, it is like a feel good. When I think of like a family movie,
I thought there was maybe a filmmaker who had Field of Dreams in their repertoire, and that was the standout of them.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm leaning to Straight Story.
Cool.
I think that would be an interesting one for me to see because it's also one of the ones I haven't seen.
Yeah, it's lovely. It's
really lovely. And also, you know me. Mm. We all have our things here at the video store.
Yeah.
And I tend to be the one that gravitates to the gooey.
Yeah.
It's heartwarming.
There's the final scene is just so lovely. It's just so simple.
Okay. Like, I'm going to push for that. Can I move on?
List of stuff.
Okay.
So it's not... So I did a list of David Lynch... It's not necessarily David Lynch films, because, I mean, you should just go out and watch all of his movies, right?
Yeah, and as you said, there's not too many.
Yeah so, okay. But obviously on top of that was The Straight Story, because it's the most un-Lynch film that you should check out to just get a different aspect of his mythos, you know what I mean?
So what is your list?
So that was one on the list, right? So
What are these? The sort of Lynch-inspired...
This is Lynch... Yeah, if you're into David Lynch, you should check this stuff out,
okay.
Right?
All right. The Lynch-adjacent list.
Yeah, so famously, David Lynch's favorite film is Wizard of Oz, right?
Okay.
Famously. You should watch Wizard of Oz if you want to understand David Lynch, right?
Cool.
Great, colorful, fucking musical, obviously the
flying
original.
Flying Monkeys.
Yeah, Flying Monkeys. To go with that, you should watch a documentary called Lynch Oz. It's Lynch/Oz. And it's a video essay film. Various filmmakers talk in it. David Lowery speaks in it. I think John Waters speaks in it as well. And they start breaking down how every David Lynch film always leads back to The Wizard of Oz.
Interesting.
And it's very interesting. It's eye-opening because I think it's the same filmmakers who did Room 365, the Kubrick one. I hated that documentary.
Yeah, it is a bit... Black.
A lot of it reaches. It's like serious reaching.
Yeah, I couldn't finish it.
I stopped. It's lunatics raving about Kubrick. This one's different, though, because it's filmmakers talking about why they think X, Y, and Z relates to Wizard of Oz. And it all makes sense. Like the curtains, the iconography. Wild at Heart, obviously the most obvious.
Oh, my God, Wild at Heart. I love them.
Yeah, most obvious references to Wizard of Oz. So that's a good one to watch. Lynch Oz, right? Then there's Art of Life, which is a documentary. It's just a series of conversations with David Lynch. And they talk about his life, how he got to Philadelphia, how he initially wanted to become a painter, and how that ties into his filmography.
Where are these all available?
So Straight Story, I think, is on Disney Plus, I think. Art of Life is on the Criterion Channel. Wizard of Oz, you can find, I think
anywhere,
it's on Netflix.
Everywhere, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, and then these ones. So Lucky is Harry Dean Stanton's final film. So Harry Dean Stanton, you'll recognize him from Paris, Texas. He was in Alien. He's one of the crew members. Great character actor. So Lucky was his final film. He was
as an actor
before he died. I think he died like 3 weeks after they shot it. The director is, his surname is Lynch as well. I think his name is like John Paul or John Paul Lynch. He's not related to David Lynch at all, but David Lynch is, he's an actor in the film. He plays a barfly who has a tortoise that's gone missing.
Okay.
And he plays a substantial part in the film. So Lucky, you'll have to fly the seven seas to get that one. But basically, the guy who directed it, he was Marge Gunderson's husband in Fargo. He was the guy who they think is the killer in Zodiac. So he's an actor, but this is a film that he directed.
Okay.
And what it's about is Harry Dean Stanton has lived his life as an atheist, but he can feel that he's going to die soon. So he tries to find one piece of enlightenment before he goes.
Okay.
And it's a lovely character study.
This
it's
is Lucky.
Lucky.
Okay.
And David Lynch is like a friend who frequents a bar that he goes to.
It's cool that he does the occasional acting. Yeah.
His Dale Cooper's boss in Twin Peaks is hysterical, is deaf. He's got the hearing aid. And then this one, so it's not David Lynch movie. He's not in it, but it's called Holy Motors. It's by Leo Carax. French filmmaker, and it's very, very Lynchian.
Yeah.
A lot of people would regard it as a French David Lynch film. It's bizarre. It's about a guy who literally, the movie is almost like vignettes where he gets in a limo, he puts on like changes his makeup and stuff, and then he goes and performs a character with no cameras filming him. But like he goes to all these weird appointments that they call it, and he just performs these characters.
Yeah, one of which is the dude who like lives in the subway.
Yeah, and so he licks Eva Mendes's armpit, and it's a very strange movie. But there's a lot of David Lynch isms in there that you can see that definitely inspired that filmmaker.
Yeah, the Bioscope screened a movie in the early days. So this is now almost 15 years ago, called Tokyo, which was like a triptych movie. It was three short films that sort of set in and around or about Tokyo.
Mm.
And Leo Carax had a short in there which was that same character, this weird sort of like hobo character. And I think he introduced it for the first time in that short where you're like, what the fuck? Who the fuck is this?
Yeah.
Like, who's this character?
Yeah.
And then you Holy Motors was the sort of expanding Holy Motors is so on strange. That.
Yeah, it's a fucking bizarre film.
Yeah, weird.
But those are my Lynch stuff.
Those are your Lynch. That's your Lynch list.
Yeah, yeah.
Lovely. Appreciate it. Over to something a little more straight and simple. We have a Tyler Perry movie, which is over on Netflix, which is for someone looking for something a little safer, a little simpler.
Yeah.
It's called The 6888. I think it's a very important movie.
Mm.
I think it's a little bit too soppy, but basically what it is it's World War II. It's telling the true story of how in the women's corps, the women wing of the army, there actually was this special regiment that was African-American women, and they helped sort out the problem that was existing in World War II, which was the mail. So as World War II expanded and
the postal service.
Yeah. Okay. As World War II expanded, sorry, that's what I mean. M-A-I-L. As World War II was getting out of hand, obviously this is something that the world had sort of never really encountered. Mm. Something as simple as the mail, sending the mail to and from the front lines, was piling up, and no one could deal with it. And this is the true story of the woman who helped sort this out. But they were still in Europe. They were still under crazy conditions. There were still bomb threats and all of this. But they were subject to, you know, the 1940s and 1950s view of not only women, but black women. Mm. Kerry Washington acts her pants off as Captain Charity Adams.
Okay.
And I just think, fucking, you know, earlier you were talking about how Mel Gibson's going to, you know, cure the woke mind virus. Nobody fucking knew about these people.
Exactly. That's why representation is important.
Nobody considers and thinks about the incredible and important work that was being done by these people. Nobody knows or imagines like a troop of black women that were in World War II, that were in Europe, and what they did and how they put their lives at risk and how they used their smarts and what they were able to do to solve this incredible feat.
Mm.
They did it in less than anyone ever thought. So they completely they were so underestimated.
Mm.
But they stood up for themselves, and this woman, Charity Adams, you know, really was a strong and credible woman, and only later is being recognized.
Yeah,
and we need these movies to tell these fucking stories, especially if they did exist.
Exactly. Yeah.
And so fucking make sure that they get made.
Yeah, representation. That's why it's so important. Like you said, there's certain aspects that people didn't know about that existed, and they're like, oh, shit.
And what an incredible story.
Yeah, exactly. So I mean, with this by Trump appointing three white men who have no interest in telling stories other than about strong white men.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, let's hope they shock us and John Voight wants to do the true story of Alexander the Great, you know? or something like that. But yeah. No, so you said it was too sappy?
Yeah. So there was points where I was like, this is, they've added another scoop of the goo. Mm.
Tyler Perry.
Yeah, right. and for me the music was laid on a bit too thick.
Yeah,
but
Tyler Perry has no nuance.
It pokes you in the stomach going like, okay, feel something now, something now. And it also, I think it could be interesting to look at it through the lens of like costume design and set, because it felt a little too dress up. So, and something that I think is cool to share, there's a great movie, The Holdovers, which we've spoken about at many points. It's a film made recently that's set in the 70s. And the director made a great comment, which is you can't just go out to a set department and get the cars from the 70s. Because you generally tend to find that if you were to go look for these old cars, they'll all be in good condition.
And cuck expensive to rent.
And cuck expensive to rent. But emphasis on the fact that they'll look new.
Yeah, that's true.
Because people would be preserving these cars or recently building them or whatever. Mm. But he's like, in the 70s, all the cars looked shat.
Yeah.
Exactly. You know what I mean? They looked old. They looked fucked up. So you can't just have a nice car in the parking lot. It's got to be a fucked car.
Yeah.
And so this was set in World War II. And there was a point where it's like everyone's costume just looked a little too pristine.
Yeah, everything's shiny. Yeah.
And there's this scene where Oprah Winfrey plays someone and they have this scene in the Oval Office.
Mm.
And it just didn't look real. It looked a bit like, you know, a day on set with the costume department, and it looked play.
Yeah.
So that ruined it a little for me. It just gave away its made-for-TV-ness.
Yeah, I get you that. Yeah.
But... Who gives a shit? It's a nice movie, and it's an important story to tell, and you're not going to waste 2 hours.
Yeah.
So it's harmless in that sense.
That's good, man.
So yeah, it's Netflix, it's the 6888 on Netflix, and very much worth your time. Should we talk about TV?
Yeah.
Should we close off on TV? I
finished a new season of Squid Game.
Yeah.
Okay.
Is it Squid Game or Squid Games?
Squid Game, I think. Yeah.
This is season two now.
Yeah.
Highly anticipated.
So
did it deliver?
I loved it.
I loved it as well.
It's pissed off a lot of people because it ended on a cliffhanger, which is something...
The first one kind of did it as well, though.
I mean, it kind of did, but the thing is, the first season kind of encapsulated the whole length of the games.
Yeah.
Where this one kind of just ended in the middle, but a new season's coming in June or July.
Yeah, so that means they definitely shot it back to back.
Yeah, like 100%. No, totally.
Yeah.
And
what do you like about it? What's cool about it?
It's just so insane, like how they'll just throw people under the bus, to make money and for quick buck.
I think I liked about this season more is the democracy of it.
Because
obviously in Squid Game they're allowed to take a vote to carry on with the games or not. So obviously this guy's now back in it. And he's trying to warn them. They're like, oh, these are the games that are going to take place. But they've changed things. So now instead of having one big vote at the beginning, they offer them the chance to end the games after each game. And they're like, cool. And like the interesting thing about this is we're seeing that dynamic of people needing to stay one more game, or like people wanting to go the whole way or needing to finish now. And it's very interesting. I like the characters more in this one than the first one.
Totally, yeah.
More well-rounded.
I could see how the narrative version, which was the first one we were presented with, would naturally lead to a reality TV show version of this game, obviously without them being shot in cold blood. what was that like? Did you watch that reality show version?
I watched the Mr. Beast version. But Beast Games. No, Mr. Beast did a Squid Game.
Oh, yes, on YouTube. Yeah.
That never paid off in the same way. I mean,
no one was executed.
are we enjoying the narrative decisions better than watching? Because obviously, it sounds like, because I'm a little on the outside. Yeah. I watched a few episodes of season one and was like, okay, I get it. But what is really great about reality TV shows is playing into the, like, what do humans do when you're stuck on an island? Or what do you do when you have to portray or fuck over people? Or, you know, how do you play the game? And it's and that's what makes those competition reality shows interesting.
Yeah.
And so you're playing on that even in the narrative. Mm.
I think, the reality game show, even though it's, like, trashy fun, they kind of missed the whole point of...
Okay, so you obviously get more out of the narrative version, which is
I think
you obviously get to know characters and
because I mean the excitement of the narrative is that these people are unaware of this. The American the game show one, everyone's aware of what Squid Games is, right? So they
they actually don't know what's
because everyone that didn't win died.
Yeah, exactly.
So like it's a big secret.
Yeah. So I mean it's the reality one is like so cheesy. Like so they obviously don't kill people in cold blood. But there are moments where they're like doing it up on purpose. So like some people were like, oh, I'm dead, I'm out. But then some are like, oh, and they're like falling and flopping on the floor and it's so
corny. All right, so it's just a bit lame.
Yeah.
And cool.
Then isn't Fincher going to do a remake?
Yeah, he's working on an American reboot, which I don't understand why we need that, but I'm only giving it some semblance of faith because it's David Fincher. But I mean, he was supposed to develop the Utopia adaptation. Did you ever watch Utopia?
Utopia?
It was a British like paranoia like thriller. It was about this comic book that was predicting like major world events.
This sounds familiar.
Yeah, the British show only did 2 seasons. It got cancelled, so they didn't finish it, which sucks. And then the American adaptation happened, which I never watched, but friends of mine who loved the original show
were like that. Fincher is going to do
Squid Games, yeah.
An American Squid Games, which just also it seems so dumb because today what's popular is the Korean version because we all get it.
It's in Netflix's biggest show ever, like most watched show ever.
And that includes America.
Yeah.
Because before I understood there could be a market, there's like a cinema market in Korea where these great movies get made and maybe some of them cross over like Parasite. But for the most part, they stay very much in Korea and perhaps a smaller indie circuit. And then it makes sense to make, you know, Old Boy with Josh Brolin. but it makes sense in theory.
Yeah, I get you.
But yeah, it seems dumb to make an American Squid Game.
Did you watch The 8 Show, Gad?
The number eight.
Check it out.
It's been mentioned on the video
the
store
eight
before.
Show.
Yeah, so
either you or Marigold.
Marigold watched it. Yeah, as well. But
she did mention it. Yes, I need to check it. Is it on Netflix?
Yeah, it's. I think it's darker and more fucked up than Squid Game. I don't think it's as fun as Squid Game, and I think it does outstay its welcome just a slight bit. But yeah, you should check it out. The 8 Show.
Speaking of dark and fucked up, I just want to mention I watched the 2 episodes. It's only 2 episodes of Jerry Springer fights camera action instead of lights camera action. It's cool. It's worth a revisit
of all those crazy stories.
What Jerry Springer was. I think I just made it in terms of the zeitgeist because it happened very much before my time. But when I was old enough, so in high school-ish,
it started
and DSTV,
I remember.
The moment DSTV came to South Africa, there was a channel called The Series Channel.
I was literally about to say, was it called The Series Channel?
Yeah, it was called The Series Channel, where they had a lot of syndicated series, but they were generally older series like Jerry Springer and Frasier and Cheers and shit like that. And so Jerry Springer, I think for the most part, had kind of stopped by that point. And I was just old enough to kind of give a shit.
Mm.
Anyone younger than me, I don't think knows who the fuck Jerry Springer was.
I discovered it on.
I think I'm one of the. I think I'm one of the younger people to give a shit about Jerry Springer.
Yeah.
So he was like a mayor of a town.
Yeah.
He's got an amazing
it was like a staple of his community.
He was a mayor in Cincinnati and whatever. Crazy. And then he found himself in the show, and I don't want to give too much away because the 2 episodes of this show outline him quite well. But I remember quite distinctly feeling that he was an outsider of his own show. It wasn't his decision. It wasn't him creating it. He was just in the room when the craziness came. But of course, very famous TV show where really everything that's fucked up and weird about the world and America. was on display. And it's a lovely portrait of how this show developed, how it became the biggest show. They start as outsiders where he was making a Oprah-esque, Ricky Lake-esque talk show, and they were at the bottom of the rung. And then they got wilder and wilder and crazier, and part of the criticism, which they do get into in the show, is how much they might have encouraged the audience and created built these environments to play out.
Yeah.
But very famously became the most ludicrous talk show where, you know, for example, the biggest thing was one guy came on who basically admitted to bestiality.
Yeah, he married his horse.
He married his horse. And of course, it's just so ridiculous.
And it's like KKK members came in. And
it's wild. And of course, you know, what happens when they leave? And I don't want to give too much away. But they end up becoming the biggest show and beating Oprah. And it's very similar. And I think someone should also consider watching or revisiting Trainwreck, which was all about the 1999 Woodstock. And I love thinking about this. I love saying something like Limp Bizkit making a song called Break Stuff, which is like, I just want to, you know, give me something to break. How about your fucking face?
Yeah.
Like, that's wild. But there will always be that. Same as there will always be a dude who wants to marry his horse. Like, there will be the fucked up, there will be the fucked up weird aggression.
Yeah.
And there will be all of that. But why and how do they become the biggest pieces of media in the world at that time?
Yeah.
That's the interesting part. There will always be a Limp Bizkit. But why were they headlining Woodstock? And why were they the biggest band in the world at that time? There was the Backstreet Boys, and then there was Limp Bizkit. You know, there was NSYNC, and there was Korn. Like, gross. Why were those bands as big as they were? They will always exist, but why were they that big? It's the same as, like, Jerry Springer will always exist, but and it could have its audience. But how did it beat Oprah at one point?
Yeah.
That says more than anything else. And I think that's the cool and interesting way to approach this, which is like, why was it as famous as it was? So that's the interesting part. It's just two episodes.
That's interesting.
It's on Netflix.
It's on my list.
Yeah, it's interesting that you mentioned the Trainwreck docu as well, because they go into how like Limp Bizkit, like frat culture was really big at the time, and like, you know, a bit of like rape culture. And
yeah,
like,
well, don't forget American Pie was the biggest movie at the time. And don't forget that, you know, the main moment in that movie was when they were spying on a woman getting changed.
Exactly.
It's like,
yeah, it all ties in together. And I mean, Jerry Springer, I distinctly remember the first episode I saw was on the Series Channel, and was the stripper episode where like all these strippers were there just fighting each other. And it was just fucking crazy. Like, what is this? I remember watching it for a while because it was so ludicrous. It was just insane. The crowd shouting, Jerry, Jerry. Yeah.
they were basically like, their philosophy was, if you were to be changing channels and switching through channels, if you get to this show,
you will
you'll see this crazy action. You'll see the title along the bottom, and you'll be like, oh my God, a dude wants to marry his horse.
Like, gotta watch this.
It's literally like a train, like a car accident. You can't not look. As much as you don't want to when you drive past one, your brain just goes like, I gotta see what the fuck happened.
I find it funny as well. Just a quick reference. Anthony Bourdain, who's like one of my heroes, he did a show called Parts Unknown. And I think it was on Parts Unknown, but he did a number of travel shows where you would... One in particular, we'd go to like the odd, almost like underbelly of each city or country.
This is a famous chef.
So he went to Tokyo, and he was going to like the weird nightlife of Tokyo. And he was like obviously overwhelmed by how fucking weird Japan is and how weird the Japanese are to him. And I remember he was talking to a Japanese guy, like his tour guide, and he was like, I don't get it. You guys think we're weird, but we think you guys are fucking weird. And like Jerry Springer, shows like that, Las Vegas, that's fucking insane. Like, Las Vegas is the highest population of what the Elvis impersonators in the world. Like,
I needed Americans during my varsity time. There was this lovely exchange program with NYU. I had them point out how fucking bizarre Monte Cassino is.
But
Vegas. No.
The Monte,
and of course,
is weird though.
But these were Americans that also still understood how strange Vegas was. But they were like, I've come to Africa
to go to Italy,
and you've got this little recreation of Italy.
Yeah.
And I was like, it is weird. It is weird. And I needed you to point that out.
Yeah.
But yeah, lekker duties.
Cool.
Thanks for a lovely day.
Yeah. Thank you.
I really enjoyed catching up with you guys. And yeah, Real Pain. Fuck.
Great
what
movie.
What a gem. And then, of course, once again, look out for our Attention All Customers post over on our Instagram page, which is The Video Store Pod. And we want to join you guys. We want you guys to join us at the special screenings of Better Man, which I think will be fun. And it'll be a good time. And it's a great chance for us to hang out with you guys and get to know you, which is great. All right. Thank you, guys. Our home base is thevideostore.co.za. And we can't wait for you to come on back next week, where we will do pretty much the same thing.
Sweet.
All right. Cheers, guys.
Cheers.
Bye.